This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
If you spend any time at all watching football, you know concussions are getting a lot more attention. Now the NFL is partnering with GE and Under Armour to promote their second Head Health Challenge, with up to $10 million at stake.
And if this leads to a usable early detection even on the sidelines perhaps, that's a game changer. Every high school in the country will have to have one of those gadgets.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to one of the judges of this competition. We'll also find out how some students in trade schools are dealing with student debt. Listen to the music of the Furry Ambers, a group made up of developmentally challenged members, and spend an academic minute with frisky honeybees. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Concussions are hot. With the amount of attention concussions have gotten recently, you'd think they were just discovered in the last decade. Well, perhaps they were. Over the years, the serious, long-term effects of even one concussion have become clearer, and there are efforts to try to better detect and prevent concussions.
And it's a progressive disorder. You know, the damage is progressive, so the more concussions one has, the more damage and the more easily they concuss in the future.
That's Dr. Ken Ford, the founder and CEO of the Institute for Human and Machine Cognition, a not-for-profit research institute located in Pensacola, Florida. He has been chosen as one of the judges of the Head Health Challenge 2. That's a competition sponsored by the National Football League as well as GE and Under Armour that's looking for innovative approaches for identifying and preventing brain injury.
It's an effort to tap the talent from around the world, even from some unexpected places, in an open competition. It's an open innovation effort. And the focus is going to be on trying to mitigate concussion, reduce the impact, reduce the number of concussions. And there are several thrust areas. They'll look at technology, but they'll also look at training and a broad spectrum approach.
There are a wide range of judges in the event that will award up to $10 million to the winning entries. Dr. Ford says each judge brings a unique set of skills.
So they won't ask this group to look at technique in the sense of how one should play football. This group would be the wrong group to ask. This group will help them select among hundreds of proposals from around the world to really try to identify some innovation nuggets that might help with training technique or equipment that would be more robust in the face of these large impacts, or even detection methods that can detect damage early and do it in real time. You know, when I was an athlete, the coach would ask you how many fingers he had in your face, or who was your professor for some course you were taking, right? So they want some people that can raise the flag, the this won't work flag, either from a medical basis or from a scientific basis or a practical basis, or in my case, a technology basis. And I think that's the mix they were looking for, is that way there'll probably be some vigorous discussion. But we can correct each other's weaknesses as a group.
So why did they ask Dr. Ford to participate?
That was the very first thing I asked them. I said, you know, I'm not a researcher in concussions, nor do I work in a hospital. I'm not quite sure why you're interested in my help. And they said that they thought that they had enough expertise along those lines, everything from people that's all they do is handle concussion, and also people that handle TBI, traumatic brain injury, for the military. They thought what they were missing was a technology person, because they anticipate that many of the proposals will be advocating for a technological approach, either better equipment or some special gadget of some kind or some magical technology that will detect it very early. And I think they would like to have somebody that would understand the technology part as well as the physiology. So I will certainly defer to these other gentlemen about brain physiology and the dangers of concussion.
And while the main sponsor of the Head Health Challenge is the National Football League, there are many places that are watching the study of concussions with interest, including the military.
Huge implications. There's a lot of commonality between concussion and TBI. and even some forms of dementia that are associated with aging. But for the military, there is a lot of overlap, and there will be a panelist from the military who has this very concern on top of his list. So the IEDs produce a tremendous concussive blast that does significant brain damage to people who are nearby. But it also has potential impact in the broader society as it relates to automobile accidents, other sports besides football. I mean, soccer has a very high concussion rate. Hockey, as you can well imagine, that's quite a few concussions. So it's broader than just the NFL and these very elite athletes.
Dr. Ford also believes that school districts should be keeping an eye on this research for their younger athletes.
They need to be. And if this leads to a usable early detection even on the sidelines, perhaps, that this person should not go back into the game and needs medical attention where this other could go back. Something better than, you know, who's your English professor? That's a game changer. Every high school in the country will have to have one of those gadgets.
The competition is already underway. Head Health Challenge 2 is accepting proposals through January 30th. Then there will be a sorting process that will narrow down the number of applicants that will actually appear before the judges.
Our task will be to sort them into we'd like to hear more and be happy not to hear any more pile. And then we'll focus on the ones that pass the filter in a second phase to get down to the number that they feel they can afford to fund.
Dr. Ken Ford is the founder and CEO of the Institute for Human and Machine Cognition, a not-for-profit research institute located in Pensacola, Florida. The first Head Health Challenge had hundreds of entries from over 30 countries. The judges for Head Health Challenge 2 will gather to sort out the best proposals in July 2014. The public radio series Changing Gears is looking at student debt. Many families struggle to afford traditional colleges, but a lot of student debt comes from attending private, for-profit schools that focus on vocational training. These students default on their loans twice as often as students from public colleges. Kate Davidson has the story of one small school battling big defaults.
America's student loan debt is now bigger than its credit card debt. It's almost $1 trillion, and default rates are rising.
I guess I do what everybody else has been doing, dodging the phone calls, you know, because we don't have $15,000 to pay.
Mark Howell is on the verge of default. In fact, the school he went to has the highest student loan default rate in Michigan. It's not U of M, not Kalamazoo College.
You stay still.
It's Barber College. In Ohio and Wisconsin, beauty schools have the highest default rates. Now, these are small schools, so their default rates are volatile. But this is a story about why those rates matter at the Flint Institute of Barbering. So picture an overgrown barbershop. It's big and cheap and cheerful.
What style of haircut do you want?
College boy.
Desmond is 5. The student palming his head like a basketball is 50. Tom Amundsen was an auto designer for 30 years, but got laid off. Enter his buddy, the barber.
He talked to me about it. He said, why don't you get into the business? And I said, kind of old. And he said, no, you're never too old to cut hair.
So Amundsen took out federal loans, just like 3/4 of his class. Martha Polis runs this school. It's $8,000 for a year. But she says most of her students are low income. So the cost of living and supporting kids and just avoiding poverty, all of it affects default rates.
The 3-year-ago rate was 15.5%. Our 2008 cohort was 29%. Our 2009 cohort, and these are the official rates, was 30.5%.
That means almost a third of those who started repaying their loans in fiscal year 2009 had defaulted 2 years later.
We were very alarmed and not happy, and we're trying to work as much as we can and do the best we can.
Now, this is a woman who will dye her students' jeans black.
I have to use a laundry tub
by hand
and stir it and leave it there for hours and hours and hours and overnight.
If they can't afford to meet the school's dress code. But in the end, she hired a service to track students who are delinquent on their loans. She says she had to. Schools with high default rates can lose access to federal student aid, and more than half the school's revenue comes from that aid.
They are so reliant on federal financial aid dollars.
David Deming is an assistant professor at Harvard's Graduate School of Education. He's talking about the larger for-profit sector, which he says gets almost 75% of its revenue from federal student aid. And as for students who borrow money...
If you take out a five-figure loan for a relatively short program, if you don't find employment relatively soon after that program, it's going to be very hard to pay back your loan.
Time slips away in between all of that, you know what I'm saying? And it is not going to wait for you.
Remember Mark Howell? He's working. He's cutting hair in a kind of hard-to-find corner of a mall in Flint, and he loves it. But he says building clientele is slow in a town that's saturated with barbers.
You can't make the payments, but at the same time, you're trying to find work to make the payments. And if you don't make the payments, you got to deal with the consequences behind that, which is your license at stake.
He's already gotten a couple loan deferments. In the meantime, he says he's scratching and hustling to make ends meet. And he's not the only one. For Changing Gears, I'm Kate Davidson in Flint.
This story was informed by the Public Insight Network. Changing Gears is a collaboration of WBEZ Chicago, Michigan Radio, and WCPN Cleveland. Support comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Still to come, we're going to hear from some furry ambers. And yes, that will eventually make sense. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1213. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. A while back, Dan, Dylan, Paul, and Paulina formed a rock band they called the Furry Ambers. While that may not sound all that unusual... Okay, Furry Ambers is unusual in a completely awesome kind of way. This band is different. All four members were born with a developmental disability. They know what it feels like to be held back and misunderstood, and they channel those frustrations into music. For the Furry Ambers, music is not only therapeutic, it's a way to make their voice heard. Emily Foreman from the SALT Radio Institute has their story.
The Furry Ambers are framed by a red wall with the words, "We born this way, people," in orange paint. Dylan braces his guitar like a safety bar on a roller coaster, but his fingers glide across the strings. Paulina rocks as she sings, her mouth open wide for extra emphasis. Dan careens forward, cradling his mandolin, while Paul takes breaks from drumming to pump up an imaginary audience with interpretive arm gestures. That's Dan on the vocals. Dan is in his 30s, autistic, and lives above his parents' garage. Relating to people is a struggle, especially when it comes to dating. He tells me about being madly in love at 11. When the girl moved to Florida, the heartbreak was so bad that he couldn't eat and was sent to a psychiatric ward to recover.
Having autism made me sort of an outsider. Even though I was never brutally repressed, like, say, the blacks of South or homosexuals, but still, it was rough enough for me that I could see where the cracks were in the American dream.
Dan's very narrowly defined interests and intense focus allow him to excel at music. His voice is well suited for Irish jigs. The vocal thrusts and political themes are the perfect tools for channeling frustrations.
Come out, you black and tans, come out and fight me like a man. Show your ways how you won medals down in Flanders.
If you're real angry about injustice in the world, you pick up the mandolin or guitar or whatever and you sing that one, and it's perfect.
The Furry Ambers got their start in September of 2011, jamming out with coat hangers and mason jars. It was Paul who chose the name, cementing the group as a band, creating a model for other participants in the Listen Up music program. Paul is Ringo Starr. He's a lovable, upbeat drummer and comedian.
You're quite the ham.
Excuse me, ham? What ham are you talking about? I'm not pork. I'm not a pig.
Paul influences the songwriting of the other band members. Oadina is about Paul's past relationship.
Ground on a knee, I hold her hand, I put a ring on her finger, and I said, "Will you marry me?" And then she said, "Yes."
But Adina called off the engagement. Paul refers to it as his divorce. Sometimes a serious breakup can feel that intense.
Someday I will be.
Rich and famous, okay?
When someone sings my song on the radio, Taylor Swift is singing my song on the radio.
Like Paul and Taylor Swift, Paulina has experienced her fair share of breakups. Of the band members, she is the queen of the brokenhearted ballad.
Been hurt a lot by guys, like I've had guys cheat on me or just want me for my looks and not for my personality. It took me a long time to learn what love was because I didn't know the proper term of love because I wasn't shown that as a kid.
Paulina grew up in Poland with a developmental disability. Her childhood was traumatic. She was sexually abused by her father and spent years in and out of orphanages and foster homes. Eventually, she was adopted by a family in Cape Elizabeth, Maine. Her primary caregivers constantly betrayed her, and that's made forming relationships hard.
It kind of helped me. It's the way I coped with my emotions at the time if I wrote it all out.
For now, Paulina has taken a break from love ballads. Her latest songs are about social injustice, topics that draw on her past but demonstrate her growth. She's become more empathetic to the world around her, a shift largely inspired by Dan's thoughtful political lunchtime chats. Dan says that people with special needs have insights that others might miss.
People with special needs often, not always, but often are spiritually evolved. And I'm not tooting my own horn there. I've seen it, I think, in Dylan.
One thing that helps with staying sober is not letting resentments get a hold of you, because then you'll end up drinking over it. So I've learned to pray for the people who insulted me, because they're doing the best they can, and even though they're not, you know, nobody's perfect.
Dylan has spina bifida, a birth defect where the nerve endings in the spine are exposed, creating a sac of fluid on the spine. In a bathing suit, it's visible. Growing up, kids teased him a lot for it. This left him with crippling social anxiety. When he was old enough, he turned to alcohol to quell his nerves. He's now 10 years sober, and music helps him cope.
And it's one of the few things I can concentrate for more than 2 hours on. I just get lost in it.
And the therapeutic benefits have a lot to do with voicing a point of view that's often swept under the rug. Some of Dan's songs are pretty eye-opening, like What Can You Do?
Father shoots his autistic son, was afraid he'd find no.
Generally, if something is not being talked about, then it's something I write. But, you know, who writes about someone killing their autistic son because they're afraid that no one, you know, out of love?
What can you do? When the world can't afford to love you, when they just want to get rid of you.
The band is working on releasing their first full-length album and practicing for their next show. Dan hopes that people can get over their prejudices and give them a chance.
The thing is, we got to get people to listen to us. If people hear bands with special needs, they might think, it'll be children's music. And then, they'll hear about, we're talking about shootings and environmental destruction and, spiritual growth. And maybe they think, maybe people with special needs have something to say.
For Salt Radio, I'm Emily Foreman.
And now we go from furry ambers to frisky bees. No, that's not another band name. It's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. Birds and bees have helped generations of parents explain an uncomfortable subject. But as Martin Hasselman, Heisenberg Fellow in the Institute for Genetics at the University of Cologne, reveals, when it comes to how bees reproduce, the explanation isn't quite so simple.
In a honeybee colony, usually one can find thousands of female worker bees, some male drones, and a single queen who lays the eggs. The question is how the different sexes arise. Male honeybees hatch from unfertilized eggs and females from those that are fertilized. In fertilized eggs, the condition of one single gene, the gene complementary sex determiner, or CSD, regulates the development of females. The queen mates with different drones multiple times during their mating flight. Consequently, a random combination of two CSD copies, so-called alleles, are passed on to fertilized eggs. If these alleles are different enough, and that's crucial information, they develop into a female. Two identical copies result into the development of diploid drones. These are, however, killed by worker bees shortly after they hatch. So there's a strong advantage to possessing a different form of this particular gene, and previously the total number of CSD alleles was estimated at about 20. We have now detected a much higher diversity of this gene. We collected bees from different places in the world and identified up to 87 different alleles in our dataset. Using an evolutionary model, we estimated that up to 145 CSD alleles may exist. One region within CSD represents a hotspot with a high evolutionary rate, giving rise to new CSD alleles within short periods of evolutionary time. Honeybees are among the most important pollinators in the world, and the fitness of a bee population depends on, among other things, the genetic diversity of these CSD alleles. Our new findings are therefore very important for beekeepers and will allow them to minimize the danger of diploid drones production by inbreeding, which may happen in honeybee breeding programs.
That was Martin Hasselman of the University of Cologne. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.